Good morning, folks. We have got a big lineup for you today. We'll visit with Congressman Troy Carter in the back half of the noon hour, and we'll talk about the Senate committee passage of Securing the Cities Improvement Act, what that means to Louisiana and the dollars headed our way. We'll also talk about the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act as well. Ron Fauché joins us in the beginning of the noon hour, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. We'll get the latest on the presidential election. Michael Heck at 11 o'clock. We've got a lot to talk about there. And he has a special guest, Paul Matthews, CEO of the Port of South Louisiana, a recent announcement, big investment here in the state of Louisiana. The other day we learned about how much of a coffee town we truly are and how important we are as it relates to importation of coffee, green beans that head here. Well, there's a coffee fest this weekend. Kevin Richards, the co-founder of Coffee Fest, joins us for a few moments to tell us about what is going on there. It will be held at the Ernest N. Morial Convention Center this weekend. We start out today with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, welcome to the show.
Hey, my pleasure, Neil. Good to be back on.
Rafi, a lot to talk about. First, let's talk about this most recent escape from the juvenile detention facility, or Orleans Parish Juvenile Court, I should say. These stories, they just keep coming, and you shake your head and you scratch your head and you just wonder, when is this going to change?
Well, right. And, you know, so I looked into this, and there's a lot of attention and focus on how quickly the media was notified of the escape. And I want to know how he escaped, not how quickly they responded. Yes, that's important. But let's face it, this kid escaped from court. And before the media could be notified, even if the media was notified in 10 minutes, that wouldn't have prevented the kid from escaping and carjacking the car that he used to get away from the facility. So I did a deep dive into trying to figure out how the kid escaped. And what I found is that under the law, under the Code of Children's Codal Article, Article 408, a juvenile, and this is a juvenile, even though when he escaped, he was actually an adult, because he was arrested last week on attempt murder, armed robbery, aggravated assault with a firearm, illegal possession of a handgun by a juvenile, illegal use of a weapon, and aggravated criminal damage to property. He was a juvenile. He was not yet 17 years old. After he was in custody, before he could be brought to court, he turned 17 years old, making him an adult. So under the Louisiana Codal provisions governing juvenile offenders, the transporting authority, which is the JJIC, the Juvenile Justice Center in New Orleans, they're the detention center for delinquent juveniles, they're bringing him to court. They bring him to court in restraints, but they can't bring him into the courtroom in restraints because of this law. And so they take his restraints off, handcuffs and shackles, bring him into court. The proceeding was a transfer to adult court. So because of the attempt murder and the armed robbery charge, the DA was petitioning the court to move this offender from juvenile court to adult court. Well, this proceeding was scheduled before a hearing officer. A hearing officer doesn't have the authority to transfer a case like this to adult court. It has to be a judge. So first off, he was brought to court before a hearing officer that didn't have the authority to do what the DA's office was requesting. So should not have even been brought to court on that day.
But you would agree, Rafi, that that's about as elementary as it gets.
Yeah, right.
In the exercise of, you know, what they're doing.
Yeah, common sense. You know, just know, you know, what you need to do. So he's brought to court for a hearing officer who can't handle the case. But he walks into court you know, with his shackles off, with his handcuffs off, and has the proceeding, and basically it gets continued. So, but during that proceeding, he finds out from his attorney that the DA intends to transfer his juvenile arrests to adult court for him to be prosecuted as an adult. So now he knows that, you know, he's really facing some
issues. He's going to big boy court now.
He's going to big boy court, exactly. So now he knows that, and he doesn't have shackles on. And as they get to the back door, he bolts. And he's gone. Hops a couple of fences, carjacks a car of a lady that was waiting for her child to leave the LSU Dental Center. And he's gone, and they're still looking for him. So basically, you know, what we saw, what caused this escape is a state law. So I spoke to people, all the different agencies involved. I spoke with people from the JJIC. I spoke to a judge. I spoke to the district attorney's office. And so the people that transport the offenders to court, the juveniles to court, they don't always have security. Sometimes they use social workers. On this particular day, I was told that a social worker brought him to court using the restraints. Had no problem getting him to court, but had to remove the restraints because in the past, when JJIC staffers bring juveniles into court in shackles, they've been admonished by judges and threatened with contempt. So they have been beaten down and conditioned that they know that they just take the shackles off. It's easier. They don't get chewed on. And they bring him to court, even though they may feel like that's not the right thing to do, it's not the safe thing to do, but they've been bullied for so long, they just don't want to fight it anymore.
Can I ask you two questions?
Yeah.
One, social worker. Isn't this guy, isn't there evidence that this guy is a gangbanger?
Yes, I was told by some officials that he has affiliations and links to local street gangs.
So knowing that, who makes the decision to send a social worker with this individual with the, you know, the alleged crimes that he committed, which are all violent in nature, and information relative to being a possible gangbanger?
I can't answer that question. I mean, obviously, you know, on any given day in the system, there's always going to, you know, we know there's staffing issues in the police department and in the sheriff's office. There's going to be staffing issues in the, you know, JJIC, the juvenile detention.
But this case highlights the downstream implications. That, for me, that's not a reasonable excuse. Right.
Yeah, I agree.
You got to make other accommodations and make things happen. Right. When you got a guy like this and the record that he has and everything else that goes along with it. So let me jump to the second question. We have this Children's Code Article 408. Who's prejudiced? These are all trials.
I agree.
There's no jury. You know,
right.
I mean, so who's actually prejudiced, you know, by this safety measure here? I mean, are the judges are not able to separate themselves and or understand that maybe handcuffs are necessary? This is the stupidest article I've ever read in my life.
Well, I mean, the first paragraph A of that article, 408, says that, you know, proceedings should be conducted with dignity and in an orderly and expeditious manner. So I guess whoever...
Where's safety there? Where's safety?
I don't see it anywhere
I read it three times. I don't see the word safety anywhere
right.
there, right? I mean, that's why this article is not worth the paper it's written on. It's ridiculous.
Well, it really is. So, you know, this law set into motion you know, this escape and probably some of the other escapes that we're wondering, how did that happen? This isn't the first offender that's escaped after a court hearing in juvenile court. And, you know, it wasn't until I did a dive on this to figure out, well, this is the law that is supposedly creating an impediment to safely transporting people, offenders, back and forth from secure custody. And, you know, the issue you raised about who's prejudiced, I spoke to a judge yesterday about this. I said, are you telling me that you, as a judge, would somehow be prejudiced by seeing a child in restraints when you know what he's been arrested for, when you know he's in custody? How is that going to render you prejudiced in any meaningful way from being able to fairly, you know, administer justice in this case? And they said, well, of course not, but that's the law, and, you know, we have to follow the law. Well, the law doesn't have any common sense. And really, you know, I've spoken to some of the JJIC officials, and, you know, the law says that if they petition the court on an individualized case, the court can grant permission to bring somebody in. Well, to think that you're going to be able to schedule it. So this kid just got arrested last week. This is his first appearance in court. Hasn't been allotted anywhere. The DA intends to transfer this case somewhere. They don't have time to request, Mother, may I? Can I bring this violent repeat juvenile offender into court in restraints? You bring them into court in restraints and explain to the judge why they're in restraints in court. And if the judge disagrees with that reasoning, it's on the judge to order the restraints removed.
And if exactly. That person, what we ought to do is amend this law to say that all kids are brought into court in handcuffs. How about that?
Yes. Yes.
Because absolutely. Safety and security is going to be paramount to everyone involved, all of the people in the courtroom.
Including the kid.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So think about this. People that are just focused on, you know, this is a 16-year-old just turned 17. And now, you know, not only is he facing an escape charge, he's facing a carjacking charge. And the attempt murder was in the process of being transferred to adult court. So did the system do any favors to this kid with this law and all of this? So, you know, again, common sense and logic have nothing to do with all of this. And for too long, you know, I think that the juvenile code has flown below radar.
Yeah.
And not only
needs to be re-engineered, it needs to be re-engineered, quite frankly.
Exactly. I mean, and this is a glaring example of why it needs to be re-engineered, because this is a chain of events that really is embedded in a state law that has been interpreted to the absurd and is resulting in not only safety risks to the public and to the court and to the people that are trying to transport the officials, but also is not doing the offender any favors either.
So just so the listening audience gains a better understanding of why we're talking about this, right? Because I get a text, you and Rafi, you know, don't talk about the kids committing mass murder in schools, malls, and churches almost monthly, and you're on your soapbox about this guy. Well, this guy, just so this texter understands, escapes from court and then does what?
Carjacks somebody. And he's in custody because of an attempt murder and an armed robbery. So this, and I was told.
So to the texter, if you were the victim of the carjacking, I know one thing for sure. I'm going to make this prediction. You would not be texting me this morning. That I know for sure.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I know that he was also recently released from state custody for serving time as a juvenile for a violent offense. So he gets out. And the purpose of you know, any criminal justice system, adult or juvenile, is to punish and to rehabilitate. And rehabilitation is even more important on the juvenile side of things. So yeah. He had apparently served his time for a violent offense as a juvenile, been released, and within a matter of a week or two, is committing the attempt murder, armed robbery, and the four other charges that he was just arrested for. So the system failed in its mission to rehabilitate this offender because he came out. I don't know what the violent offense was that he was serving time for, but I know the violent offense that he perpetrated as an attempt murder and an armed robbery, and I know that after his escape, he committed another violent offense, a carjacking, and now he's facing potentially decades in the penitentiary as a 17-year-old because the system is broken. The system is not working.
Yeah. You know, this is just another failure in the list of failures coming out of the juvenile justice system. And, you know, I've read all the stories about this, and I would be remiss if I didn't say the following. The NOPD and whatever other law enforcement agencies out there that had to put their hands on this kid multiple times, placing themselves at risk because he obviously has a propensity for violence, nobody ever talks about that, right? We don't talk about that until we have an officer seriously hurt or killed. And then we talk about it. And then we talk about thoughts and prayers and everything else. We never mention the fact that these men and women that are risking their lives out on the street each and every day have to over and over and repetitively put their hands on these impact criminals on our streets, and no one ever talks about it. And we make these silly-ass mistakes all day long, and if judges are browbeating security people for bringing juveniles into court for being handcuffed, they should be the very individuals that have a desire and should speak out against Children's Code Article 408. Because if, I promise you this, the first time that kid jumps across that banister and across that bench and wraps his hands around the neck of that judge, guess who's going to want 408 changed? Yeah. That's a better bet than Secretariat, right?
Right. You know? So what's happened, yeah, I've spoken to people from the DA's office, I've spoken to the court, and I've spoken, as I said, to JJIC officials. And the DA and the JJIC officials are going to work on some protocols, and they will present those protocols to the court. And I said that someone needs to be there to represent the JJIC officials when they bring an offender into court in restraints and the judge wants to, you know, litigate Article 408 and threaten the JJIC officials for not complying with the law. That has to be the district attorney's office. So I've spoken with them about that. They've agreed to work with the JJIC. They are just as upset as everybody else with the situation. And it's going to require the criminal justice system not to just bury their head in the sand and say, well, that's just the law. We can't do anything until the law has changed. No, that's wrong. They can do something about it now, and it needs to happen now. And I think there is that sense of urgency, at least with respect to the district attorney's office and the JJIC officials. They're working on some protocols. They've agreed to do that. They'll present it to the court, and I'll follow up on it and see where that stands. But in the meantime, I'm also, you know, going to talk to some legislators about amending Article 408 to remove the language that I think has put into motion a chain of events that's creating a safety risk to the public and to the officials of the criminal justice system.
Well, I think it's time for the governor to call a committee together, the same way that they established this Children's Code in the first place, to have this review, to gain a better understanding of how we end up with articles like this that are onerous. And I did fail to mention the transporting officers from, you know, the JJIC that are bringing them to court all the time. They're at risk. as well as that social workers at risk. All of these people are at risk. And, and as you pointed out, you read this article, you don't see the word safety anywhere in there.
Right.
You know, we are obsessed with the criminal defendant. I mean, it's like craziness. We got the tail wagging the dog, and we wonder why we have repeat offenders, right?
I mean,
it's amazing to me. Got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goinecci, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. So just in case you're not depressed enough, as we talked about this breakdown in common sense in juvenile court, we seem to have a breakdown in common sense in criminal district court as well. Rafi, tell us about this craziness.
Okay, yeah. Anyone that's driving, they may want to pull over before they listen to this. But so yesterday, the pedophile priest, Father Lawrence Hecker, was scheduled for trial. And this case was allotted last September to Judge Ben Willard. Case has gone through all the pretrial motions, scheduled for trial yesterday. So that this case, you know, goes back decades, where the DA's offices had to interview and prepare for trial for the last month or longer in preparation for trial yesterday. They walk into court and they find out that Mr. Hecker, former priest Hecker, is not in court. He has a urinary tract infection, and he's at the hospital. So the judge goes into chamber to talk to, supposedly, I'm told, Hecker's medical practitioners about whether he can appear in court. The judge walks out of chambers and informs the defense and prosecution he's transferring the case. And they said, "What do you mean?" And he says, "I'm recusing myself from this case because I won't be disrespected anymore." So I got my phone started to blow up yesterday morning, you know, when this news was breaking. So I pulled out the docket master, started to look at this case. This case, as I said, was allotted to Willard in September of 23. September the 9th, there was a final hearing before the trial, and everything was set to go, and the judge had no problems with him unable to be fair and impartial. So we walk into court on the day of trial, and the judge says, "Go home, I'm recusing myself." And his only cryptic comments was that, I'm not going to be disrespected anymore. So last month, on August the 20th or so, there was a trial in Judge Willard's court involving a sex offender. It was a jury trial. One of the jurors approached one of the female district attorney staff members and made some inappropriate and unwanted comments about her appearance. She ignored the first encounter, but there was a second encounter because this is a multiple day trial. Mm-hmm. She goes to the court and she goes to her supervisor and informs them, this is the second time this same juror is making inappropriate comments to me. So they bring that information to the judge. And the judge says, you know, essentially to the woman, "You're a distraction." Essentially saying she's too attractive. "You need to get out of this court. Bring somebody else in from your office to handle this." Well, the people that were trying the case notified the first assistant. The first assistant goes into court and immediately asks the judge to recuse himself. The judge won't respond to that motion for recusal. And the first assistant calls the judge a coward. And the judge leaves the bench, directs a sheriff's deputy to eject the first assistant from the courtroom. So that first assistant in that rape case that called the judge a coward was also one of the attorneys trying the case involving Lawrence Hecker, the priest, the pedophile priest. So the judge would have known that. The judge has had this case for a year. The judge had a hearing in early September, and he knew who all the attorneys were, but he did not recuse himself at any point in time until the morning of trial. And the district attorney's office had to not only get the victim in this case, but they're using system and intent to show prior bad acts. They had to find other victims of Lawrence Hecker, and they had to interview them and prepare them for trial. They had to get all of the forensics, all of the medical staff, all of the police officers that were involved in this case, all ready to go to trial, only to be sent home when the judge walks out and blindsides not just the prosecution but the defense too with what I'm recusing myself from this case. That is unacceptable. And I believe that the judge has done a disservice, not just to the victims and witnesses and to both the defense and the prosecution, but the judge is also undermining, you know, public confidence in the criminal justice system. Stories like this leave you scratching your head and shaking, you know, shaking your confidence in the ability of the system to do its job. And, you know, Judge Willard, I think, is an embarrassment. I believe that his actions are a violation of judicial canons. Judicial Canon 1 says a judge shall personally observe high standards in conduct. This is not high standards. This is not suitable conduct by a judge. And Canon 3 also says that a judge shall perform their duties of office impartially and diligently. And I think continuing a case, recusing himself on the morning of trial, where if the judge felt that at any point in time he couldn't be fair and impartial, he could have self-recused himself at any point in time over the past year. He didn't choose to do that until the morning of trial. And that is unacceptable. And I think that the judge is in violation of judicial canons, and I think he owes the public an apology.
I mean, this is juvenile behavior at best, right? I mean, to make the allegation of a member of the district attorney's office that basically she is guilty of aggravated attractiveness, right?
Yes.
I mean, right. His conduct is not that far apart. There's not a wide chasm between his conduct and the conduct of the juror that they were complaining about. I mean, think about it for a moment. I mean, this is a joke. I mean, it's an absolute joke.
We've lost sight of what we're trying to do,
right?
Yep. Right.
I mean, how discriminatory is that comment to a woman? Oh, I'm sorry, right. You're too attractive to do anything in my court. What? Excuse me? I mean, you know, where are we going with this? And then ask her to leave where she can't fulfill the duties and obligations of her job in the representation of her office in the middle of a trial?
The judge is telling the prosecutor to bring somebody else in that may not be familiar with the case to take over the case.
Well, this is my prediction. The Louisiana Supreme Court is going to do nothing because they have a history of doing nothing. And it's going to be interesting to see whether or not there's anything done there, because that is if that is in fact what this judge said, it is totally inappropriate. And no one should stand for it, quite frankly. And I stand with Jason Williams in his frustration and his aggravation as it relates to this case. Things are tough enough, right, with the shortages and everything else they have there. They don't need juvenile behavior by elected judges to make it even worse. But that's exactly what's happening here, right?
Agreed.
We have a shortened period of time today. I do have another guest to bring on. Rafi, thank you so much for joining us today. We truly appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care. Bye.
All right, folks, we'll be right back. When we come back, we'll visit with Kevin Richards, co-founder of Coffee Fest. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Just the other day on this show, we had a lengthy conversation of the role that the city of New Orleans plays as it relates to coffee in America. More than 20 billion cups worth of coffee beans come through this port each and every year. And as long as I've lived here, I mean, I knew we had this participation in coffee, but I had no idea to what extent. And it was really an eye-opener for me. And that's part of what we're going to talk about now with Kevin Richards, co-founder of Coffee Fest. It's long overdue that we start talking about the fact of the impact that the city of New Orleans has on the coffee industry. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Newell. I appreciate you having me on.
So it was an eye-opening conversation I had with the Port of New Orleans and some folks that also are distributors and roasters here in the city, of the breadth and depth of our participation in that commodity. I mean, it was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, the coffee economy here in New Orleans is extensive, and sometimes it's just underappreciated because so much of the activity occurs a little bit out of sight. So when you think about the Port of New Orleans and all those beans being unloaded, you know, they're on the other side of a big wall, not a lot of eyeballs from, you know, consumers on that activity. Then you think about those beans needing to be stored at big giant storage facilities like Dupuy Storage over on the Industrial Canal. Again, it's a little bit out of sight, out of mind, but it's an enormous infrastructure of coffee storage. And yeah, we push that, you know, 20 billion cups of coffee a year through New Orleans in a way that's just a little bit quiet. And so as part of what we were trying to do with the NOLA Coffee Festival is just to start to celebrate a little more loudly with folks that, yeah, there's a real coffee economy here. It's real jobs, apart from just, you know, sort of loving coffee and you know, like drinking it. There's just this massive infrastructure behind it.
Well, I can tell you from a personal experience, there's no one more important than my barista at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm there every morning at 6 a.m. And that's the most important person in my life at 6 a.m. for sure.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is that barista making that cup of coffee for you is the very last step in an extremely long journey that starts with a plant, you know, potentially on a little mountain hill in some high altitude portions of Central or South America, or maybe Ethiopia, or maybe Vietnam, where a bean is on a plant and it gets picked, it gets harvested, it gets processed, it gets exported. It then lands at a port. It then lands in a warehouse, then makes its way to a roaster who actually roasts it and then, you know, potentially sells it to a coffee shop who in turn hands you that cup of coffee. It's an amazing commercial enterprise coffee is. And that's why, you know, 2.5 billion cups a day worldwide of coffee are consumed.
Absolutely. So tell us about this opportunity with NOLA Coffee Festival this weekend.
Yes. So our event is this Friday and Saturday at the New Orleans Convention Center. The intent of the festival was, again, to raise sort of awareness for the importance of coffee in our region. So historically, you know, coffee's been present in Louisiana since the late 1700s when it first came by way of the Caribbean and the French to our shores. And in the time since, New Orleans has developed the reputation of being kind of a coffee city. Now, some would say that Seattle and maybe Portland have kind of seized the coffee title from us, but we beg to differ. So we wanted to create an event where we could bring coffee professionals, those that, you know, do this for a living, as well as coffee enthusiasts that just love coffee and love finding the new best coffee in town and kind of geek out on how things are roasted and all the cool things that you could correlate to fine wine and fine spirits. I mean, coffee is every bit as complex when it comes to how it's produced, where it comes from. And so we want to help showcase that. So at the event, we'll also have quite a lot of education. We have four classrooms with over 50 classes over the 2 days, where you can kind of have freshman to senior level classes that you get exposed to, whether it's brew methods or roasting techniques or, you know, just simply coffee history, which we have a lot of here in town.
And more importantly, there will be over 25 regional coffee roasters there, and you can taste their coffee. So you get to figure out which one, what you like best, obviously, and there's an opportunity to gain a better understanding from that to your cup about that particular coffee that you enjoy. For more information, you can go to www.nolacoffeefestival.com. The tickets are, is it $20 for the 2 days or each day? $20 if you attend?
Yes.
And it's getting bigger and better every year. This is a second annual festival, right?
That's right. Yep, we had a great first year and decided to come back for a second.
So it's Friday, September 27th, Saturday, September 28th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the New Orleans Ernest N. Morial Convention Center Hall I. So don't miss it, folks. Get out there and taste your best coffee. Kevin Richards, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Michael Heck, a.k.a. DJ El Camino, president and CEO of G&O Inc. And on the back half of the hour, we'll visit with Paul Matthews, the CEO of Port of South Louisiana, as our special guest. And just a reminder, in the 12 o'clock hour, Ron Fauché is coming our way, as well as Congressman Troy Carter. So stay tuned. Plenty of ground to cover. We'll be right back.